From WXXI News, this is Connections from the Little Theater. I'm Evan Dunson. We are with Karen DeWitt, our Capitol Bureau correspondent, for another hour. She's with us here in Rochester, and you just heard her describing her experience covering the Capitol state government for 27 years for New York Public Radio. We happen to think that she's the best reporter in Albany, and it's an absolute treasure to have her on staff. It's great to have her here. She's here with us, and she's joined this hour on the stage with us at the Little by the Majority Leader of the Assembly, Joe Morelli, and Minority Leader of the Assembly, Brian Kolb. Hi, guys.
Hey,
good afternoon. How are you?
It's great to have you both here. Is it strange to hear applause for political leaders? It's nice.
Occasionally we get applauded.
No, you know, I know.
They get it more than reporters, believe me.
You probably do. Listen, you know, Karen, you mentioned earlier this in the last hour that we've had our issues with the media in dealing with political leaders, but generally not these guys. So.
No, definitely. You guys are both gentlemen, and you know. Know how to behave yourselves more than some of the people around there, right? We put you on the good side of the ledger.
Well, and Joe and Brian, can I just ask right off the bat here? I mean, you are on opposite parties, but you've always, and I'm not just saying this because you're here together, you've always spoken really highly personally of each other. I mean, Joe, you feel that way.
I love working with Brian. We have a lot of dialogue between us. We work very hard at our respective jobs. I think while we recognize we may not see eye to eye always on policy, I think Brian and I strive to make sure there's decorum in the chambers, that members are civil with one another, and while members may disagree, we don't want them to be disagreeable. The public's interest is served when we engage in thoughtful dialogue. So we talk often, and as I said, I think we tend to agree on our sort of approach to how the chambers ought to be run and how the assembly ought to be run. So I find it a joy to work with them.
Brian?
Well, when I first started many years ago, Mike Bragman was the majority leader. And I actually went up and introduced myself. I was a first-term rookie in the assembly, and he didn't even acknowledge my presence, which the mood in the chamber at that time in the assembly was very acidic and very partisan, similar to what you see in Washington. That's changed dramatically. I've enjoyed great working relationships with Joe's predecessors, Paul Tokaz and Ron Canestrari. But to the next level, as I became minority leader, or was minority leader when Joe became majority leader, we have also had tremendous mutual respect for each other because we know we're doing our jobs on behalf of the people we represent and on behalf of our public policy views. And we strive very hard, both of us in the chamber, to remind our members that when you're debating, debate on the merits, not on the personalities, not on the political parties. And Joe, who's got a tougher job than I do from the standpoint he's got a lot more headcount to deal with in the assembly, although I try very hard to reduce that headcount to help Joe in that regard. But you're talking about independently elected individuals from all across the state with different constituency groups and trying to manage all that and get business done in a respectful way is a tough job, and Joe has just done a tremendous job with that on behalf of the Assembly Democrats, and I really do respect him and enjoy working with him.
That's enough niceties.
Yeah, well, no, I was just going to say, though, it is true that I do find myself these days reporting much more on the unique dynamics, let's say, of the state Senate, as we discussed in the first hour here, than I do with the Assembly and whether people get along or not.
Well, let's start with where they may disagree. Brian mentioned right before the hour began that, you know, when you look back at the recent budget process, I was asking what's your biggest disappointment or you know, what bothered you most about what you saw? You kind of just talked about the process in general, but how would you answer that question, Brian?
Well, exactly the process, and it really starts with the public. The public and where the public gets their information is through the media and the press, and there's certainly not, what I believe, adequate time to digest publicly the final budget. You have the governor's executive budget, then you have the two majorities' budget ideas or resolutions. You have public hearings to kind of kick around all those concepts, but until the final budget is negotiated, everything is still in a state of flux. So my view is that when the final budget is done and negotiated, that should be able to be presented to the public for at least 3 days. So everybody gets a chance to weigh in on what is now going to be voted in on, And that hasn't been the case for a while, but this year was probably the worst I've seen.
Joe, do you disagree with that assessment?
Well, certainly there are constraints to what we're able to do. I mean, one of the challenges is the budget is north of $160 billion. And if you were to look at it, it's literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages long. So if we were to have the kind of detailed analysis that I think we would all want, in some ways there's a practical problem with doing that, and it would take us years to look at even one budget. So we have one of the shortest budget adoption cycles in the country. The governor presents a budget the latter part of January, and we're required really by March 31st or April 1st to have our fiscal plan in place. So it does require an awful lot of work, and it requires some discussions that aren't entirely public. Having said that, we do go through now the governor presents. We publish what's called our yellow book, which is the assembly's analysis of what the governor has proposed to us. The Senate does a similar thing. Then we present a public resolution, which offers not only the areas in which we agree with the governor, but where we find disagreement. The Senate does that as well. And then we go through a process where we try to negotiate those differences and come with a completed budget. But it is not, because of the shortness of the amount of time with which we have to work, it is not as public a process as I think any of us would like. We do have about 13 joint hearings with the Senate and the Assembly Finance Committee, so the public, although that ends up being oftentimes groups like the School Boards Association or the various interested parties who will come and present testimony. That is a rather lengthy and involved process, but it's hard to really fully appreciate this without recognizing the context of how large the state budget is. So clearly it could be better, but I think one of the things that would be probably best served is if we move the process a little later and made the start of the fiscal year a little later in the calendar year.
All right, but there's been this growing trend of having all these unrelated issues in the state budget. I mean, this year, for instance, we authorized Uber and Lyft upstate in Long Island. Last year it was raising the minimum wage. These don't really have anything to do with state spending. And you're getting more and more of these items in. And as you know, we saw this year, it's passed quickly. It's passed in the middle of the night. There's not a lot of public discussion. I can understand that there's impetus because you got to do the budget then. It's a time that everybody agrees. But it's really becoming what's called around Albany, the big ugly. I mean, shouldn't these issues be in the rest of the session when you could have, air them a little bit more?
Well, I would tend to agree with that, yes. And I think it's, without getting too much into the weeds, first of all, the state constitution empowers the governor greatly when it comes to budget making. The executive budget, which goes back now the better part of a century, gave the governor a lot of power. But two things.
Yeah, and governors use it, this governor, yes.
No, that's right. But two things more recently have really further changed the balance of power. One is an old lawsuit, Court of Appeals decision, Silver v. Pataki, which essentially said that the governor, to your point, Karen, can now embed in an appropriation bill all types of things that relate to statute that don't really have anything to do with the appropriation. The thinnest connection can co-join those things, and the legislature has to deal with that. The second is a decision made by Governor Patterson, very clever on his part. His last budget, which was dragging on, was the latest in state history in terms of adoption. And the governor decided, rather than giving the legislature an emergency spending bill, which requires either a yes or no, either you stop spending altogether or you do an emergency budget proposal, he embodied everything that was left in his budget for the remainder of the year and said, this is an emergency bill. Yes or no. And so
the government would shut down, right? And it would be your fault.
And you have that choice. And honestly, since then, Governor Patterson and certainly Governor Cuomo has been able to leverage that to say, first of all, we'll consider things, as Karen rightly points out, that aren't strictly speaking appropriation items, but I'm going to put those in my budget in the appropriation bills. And secondly, if you don't by March 31st decide to enact a budget, I'll then impose essentially with a yes-no vote, the budget that I want or some other version of that budget that I want. And then under the Constitution, the legislature has no ability to amend anything after April 1st without a message of urgency. And I won't get further into the weeds and further glaze the eyes of everybody who's watching, but there are reasons why the process has gotten to a point where it is, and I think there are many of us in the legislature who think a reform of that budget process is really needed.
Yeah, it's not a good trend. is it? And especially, you know, somebody like you, Assemblyman Kolb, you're kind of left out of that, being the minority party, too. So you don't even get to weigh in on all these unrelated issues in probably a way that you might like to.
Well, we certainly weigh in. I'm not sure if anybody's listening to us.
I listen to you, Brian.
You know, and that's really fundamental. And what Joe said is absolutely accurate. However, I think that moving back into the process, there has to be more pushback from the legislature to some of these governor's moves before we've got the gun at our head on March 31st. And I think that's probably one of my frustrations with media coverage in Albany. They tend to focus, obviously, understandably so, the two majorities and the governor. And we put out there, our role in the minority is to hold the majorities accountable in both houses and also with the governor and agree where we agree. And if we disagree, what's your idea? It's not about saying no. And that's exactly something we pride ourselves in. And we have really advocated not just for the minority leader of the state assembly to be in negotiations in terms of conversations, but also the minority leader of the state Senate, Andrea Stewart Cousins. And my whole view is our conferences represent millions of people. And we can count. You can be at a table with all the legislative leaders representing their conferences. And if you're outvoted by the governor and the two majorities, well, that's fine. That's democracy. But at least have both those people, whoever they are, in the room to present their conference's reactions to the executive budget and to the give and take back and forth. And I remember one occurrence when Governor Patterson was governor, and he did actually include the minority leaders with a budget discussion, and we were talking about school aid. And I said, well, I think our first priority in school aid support should be for the most neediest school districts in the state. And believe it or not, Shelley Silver said, I agree. John Sampson said, I agree. Mm-hmm. Dean Skelos, Republican, said, disagree, which is fine. We had this meeting back and forth. When it was all said and done, Governor Patterson, by the way, Brian, those guys don't like you in the meeting. and that's really because we're putting them on the spot with a different viewpoint that they have to now respond to, good, better, and different. And I'm not even saying my way is the right way, but I think they should have a corporate responsibility to have everybody at the table, because I think five heads are better than three or four, whatever may be in the room at a given time.
Well, yeah, it is a unique budget decision-making process in New York. What you're referring to, the three men in a room, now four because they let the Senate IDC leader, Senator Klein, in. And yeah, your position and Andrea Stewart Cousins, who's the head of the Senate Democrats, you're totally left out, and that does seem like it's not a good way to make decisions.
Go ahead, John.
I would just offer a slight dissent, and I certainly appreciate the perspective of both Brian and Karen representing the media. But to be clear, we don't operate in a vacuum. So every consideration, every time you're having a conversation, we certainly consider greatly what the minority is saying, how the press will report it. So no one in our society, it's a great thing about democracy, no one acts in a vacuum or without some accountability, which is why it's important for the press to report on it, why it's important for the minority to comment publicly and privately, because we recognize that they're going to have valid points to make, and that does, in a sense, govern what we do. So it may not be immediately obvious, but I guarantee you every single time we have a conversation about policy, I'm talking to my colleagues about what I expect Brian and his colleagues will say, and we're certainly talking about how the press is going to react to it. So we are all governed by the forces that, you know, swirl around us.
Let me ask a question that I can at least say the last time Brian was on, we had this plan to spend the hour talking about a wide range of issues, and our listeners really zeroed in on the question on college tuition and free college tuition and came from a lot of different perspectives there. And before this program this morning, I had an email from a listener saying, please bring this up. You know, we want to hear what our legislative leaders have to say. So, Brian, why don't you remind our listeners what has sort of gone on there and your perspective on free college tuition. Sometimes we think free college tuition, and it seems to be this idea that, well, now college is free for everybody. And that's not necessarily the case. But why don't you update our listeners and give us your thoughts first on that?
Well, I think first and foremost, the issue is the cost of a college education is very high, and families are struggling to help their kids get through a college education, which is understandable financially, or the students themselves. And actually, Governor Cuomo had a proposal, what has been referred to as free tuition, that focuses on the public school system and provides other limits in terms of how students would be eligible for assistance from state government. Assembly Republicans, Assembly Minority Conference, we actually, before we got to the point of acting on this particular proposal in the budget, we presented a college affordability plan that dealt with all schools, a public, private, and also graduate students, where we already have an existing program with tuition assistance program, so why reinvent the wheel? Just increase those eligibility grants and also increase the income eligibility to cover more people. And the last thing we had was part of a tax relief program for those students mired in debt in terms of getting some of their an income tax reduction. Our belief was we were going to hit a lot more students with our plan than the governor's plan, and I still maintain it to this day. But when you talk to the average person on the street, usually the reaction is, what about me? What about my son or daughter that's burdened with current debt? This doesn't help them at all with their student debt. Why is it that just public school students get this benefit and not private schools? Why is there a restriction on the number of credit hours you have to take? And of course, they're still changing this thing, you have to stay and work in New York State for 4 years if you receive tuition. Well, that's great if there's a job, and that's kind of the whole point. So my feeling was, I think conceptually the heart's in the right place with the governor's plan, but I think fundamentally and functionally what we had proposed was covered a lot more students and provide a lot more relief than that plan has been proposed.
Well, I think you can't compete with the phrase free, right, which is something that the private colleges have been complaining about, because it's just really hard when people hear free tuition, they think it's free. But as you just explained, there are some caveats, and you still have to pay for room and board, which is twice as much as the average tuition at public colleges. So it's not really free. But it's really hard to argue with somebody going for a step in, helping people go to college and at least in the future not be saddled with as much debt. But there isn't any plan, as far as I know, right, in New York State to help students, former students who are struggling right now with a lot of debt.
Yeah, let's ask Majority Leader Morelli to weigh in on that. Go ahead.
Well, shockingly, I will actually agree with Brian to some extent. This is where I say a disclaimer. These are my views and not the views of the management or the other members of the Assembly majority. I actually operate from a fundamental belief, which is everyone ought to be entitled to have the opportunity to access higher education if it's appropriate for that individual. It's not appropriate for everybody. Not everyone wants to go to college, but we should certainly, particularly in a knowledge age, try to make a college degree obtainable for as many people as we can. Having said that, I went to SUNY Geneseo, which is a great school. I thank the people at Temple Brith Kodesh who had the lack of wisdom in hiring me and allowing me to work my way through college. Every weekend I would come home, work at the temple. So I actually believe in contributing to your own education, whether it's sweat equity, whether it's some contribution. I think there's having skin in the game is a good idea, which is why I would have preferred the state take a role in restructuring the debt for long-term debt. Some of these student loans are at 8 or 9%. It's absolutely an embarrassment in this country that you'd have to pay that kind of interest rate. And now students in school, I think, get lower rates, but some of the longer standing ones, I would have restructured that debt where it's appropriate. I would actually, to Brian's point, suggested and continue to suggest and hope we'll expand part-time tuition. So think about this. If you're a single mom, you're working, but you'd like to go to be able to get either an associate's degree or a baccalaureate that would improve your chances have a better job in the future, it's almost impossible to do with the construct we have. You don't have any assistance for those types of people, and frankly, I would argue, not only for people who are looking to get into the workforce, but those people who are incumbent workers. In this day and age, in the marketplace that we have, it's very difficult to see how you could stay in the same job for 20, 30, 40 years without having to upgrade your skills, so I think we should do more of that. And frankly, as it relates to room board, your point is well taken, Karen. But in every region of this state, there is a community college, and there's typically a public college or a public university. So I think room and board, while that, I understand if you want to go away, that's a burden you have to cover. But I think actually in terms of going to school, we have afforded opportunities in terms of both public and private. And I would also enhance the tuition assistance program. It's the most generous program of its kind in the nation. It's very expensive to expand eligibility, but I think that's where our money would be well spent. But I think everyone should contribute to their own education. And so I know, to Karen's point, everyone likes the phrase free this, free that, but we have to calibrate as to what our ability to pay for things is, and I think we should make it as easy as possible to obtain it, but I think everybody has to make a contribution of their own.
Well, you're talking about addressing student debt. There is still four weeks left to the legislative session, right? Do you see any momentum for revisiting this?
11 days and counting.
11
not that
days,
I'm counting, but.
Yeah. But spread out over to the end of June. I mean, is there any momentum for revisiting this? And that leads actually to a larger question that I had is, you know, Governor Cuomo has kind of abandoned the state capitol. He said a few weeks ago, I think over Easter, he said, the session's over, I got everything I wanted from the budget, and he's hardly been in Albany. I mean, do you see anything constructive getting done? I know that there's a lot of issues out there, but it seems right now the Assembly has one version, the Senate has another version. I mean, you're going to get together on some of these issues, or what's going to happen?
I do think, actually, in some respects, much of the work that we would have been doing now was sort of encapsulated in the state budget, certainly.
Yeah. As we mentioned, Uber and all
Right, Uber, Lyft, and some of the other issues that we dealt with, the Clean Water Act, that we did have an appropriation, but obviously there's concern about safe drinking water. We're going to be focusing on, I'm going to be focusing on relief for people who are suffering from victims of the flood. You know, Brian and his conference and his colleagues have been working with myself and Harry Bronson in the Assembly, and we're reaching out across the aisle to work with our colleagues in the Senate on that. There are a number of issues that we'll deal with. Some will be local in nature. Some will be statewide. We're looking at how to change law relative to child abuse victims. That's been something that's been talked about for a number of years. I think we're getting very, very close on that issue. I think there may be other issues related to reform and ethics reform. I'm not sure how exactly it works. There are substantially different, significant differences between the Senate's view of this and ours. We'd like to reform housekeeping accounts. We'd like to close the LLC loophole. There's some things related to outside income that I think the Assembly majority would like to do. I just don't think we have a partner in that. So there are enough things to do. But some of the bigger issues will probably wait until next January, I would guess.
I mean, is it more difficult with the governor being absent for the momentum to build for things to be done?
You know, I'll say this. I mean, in this day and age, whether the governor's physically in Albany or not, he casts a long shadow. I describe Andrew as being a force of nature. I'm sure he's already thinking of what he wants to do in the last couple of weeks. And so he'll be in Albany because he, frankly, can't help himself. So, and we want him to be there. Honestly, it's hard to operate without the chief executive.
It does seem like he's got to come up with some issue that he can be a driving force on, that he's going to be unable to leave it all alone. I agree.
Well, I think that Joe's earlier points about the advantage that the governor's had in the budget negotiations is tough to deal with. Dealing with the rest of the session, though, we really don't have to worry about that in the legislature. We can pass a bill in both houses. Negotiate a bill, hopefully, on whatever the topic is, and then send it up to the governor. And if he doesn't like it, let him veto it, send it back, and we'll override the veto. I think if there is will on whatever topics they are, whether it's small business tax relief, whether it's dealing with economic development reforms and transparency, whether it's dealing with the cost of unfunded mandates and local tax relief, fixing the STAR, get rid of this STAR rebate program and go back to the STAR program that what was, the legislature can do all those things. Right. And so it's always hard to get a bill agreed upon, as Joe pointed out, on some different topics, but there's no doubt that we can do as much as the soul is willing to do that we don't need the governor to do in this session.
Well, I don't disagree. The STAR rebate is a perfect example. We passed the bill in our house with unanimous support on both sides of the aisle. We haven't been able to get the Senate to do it. We tried to make some improvements in the state budget, but our version, which is really to go back to the prior system, in my view, makes a lot of sense. The Senate could pick that up at any time, send it to the governor. I don't disagree. But by the same token, I find it hard to believe that Governor Cuomo is just going to sit on the sidelines for the last 3 weeks of the legislative session.
But as Brian mentioned, the legislature does have its own powers. You're your own separate part of government. You have the power base. But we really have not seen the legislature act independently in a long time, not since the era of Governor Pataki, when I think Pataki at some points kind of got tired of being governor in some ways and would sort of walk away. And we had a lot of issues that the legislature would pass and then the governor would veto and they would actually override his veto. But we just haven't seen that dynamic. I mean, is the will there to do that, act independently?
I think what's complicated is the situation in the Senate where they have sort of three pieces, maybe a fourth. They have the Republican Conference, they have the Democratic Conference, they have the Independent Democrat Conference, and then you have a friend of mine, Simca Felder, who's elected as a Democrat from Brooklyn, but sits in on the Republican Conference, so he's kind of the free radical. And honestly, even within the Senate Republican majority, there's I don't think I'm telling tales out of school. There's tensions there.
That's right. Between upstate and Long Island, there's that inner tension. You're right.
Yeah. So the number one person position in the Senate is the majority leader, who's John Flanagan from Long Island. The number two position is held by John DeFrancisco. That's the deputy majority leader. So it sort of lines up like the speaker and majority leader in our house. And where the speaker and I have a wonderful relationship, and we talk several times each day, and we're in lockstep in terms of, you know, what we're doing in terms of leadership of the House, that's not the case in the Senate. So even among the Senate Republicans, you have these sort of at least two groups, and it's really made negotiating with them on any substantive issue very, very difficult. That's not I don't mean that as much a criticism it sounds, it's just the practical reality that they can't really organize to get 32 votes for many things. So it's made it much more challenging. It may make for a lot of good press, and Karen writes about it a lot more than she writes about us, but I'm not complaining about that. It's the reality.
Yeah.
But it does make it harder to govern.
Yeah, there is no question the Senate is pretty much in disarray right now, and that does make it, I could see how that could make it quite difficult to get anything to go through.
Why don't I take our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back and we'll do this. We'll start off with one more from Karen DeWitt, because my goal is to get out of the way and let Karen DeWitt, our Capitol Bureau correspondent, do most of the questions and the answers for us here. She's here, after all, in Rochester at the Little Theater for our broadcast here with a live audience. And audience members, if you've got questions, you can head down to the microphones that you see, and we'll take your questions for the rest of the hour as well. So let's get this break. We'll come back with the majority leader and the minority leader of the New York State Assembly, Joe Morelli and Brian Kolb, Karen DeWitt, and our live audience at the Little Theater. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, we sit down with Dr. Pedro Noguera, who's an internationally recognized education scholar. He's in Rochester for the day, and he'll be focusing on how to build schools that serve all children well. Then in our second hour, you might have heard the term microbiome come up in a number of health venues. What is it really? How does it impact our health, and what should we know about it? Talk to you Thursday. Welcome back to Connections, live from the Little Theater. I'm Evan Dawson, and Karen DeWitt, at least one more from you. You're here, so what do you want to talk
about?
Well,
I did want to get a little bit back more into ethics reform. I mean, we do have the two former majority leaders of the legislature now facing jail time for corruption. We have 9 former associates of Governor Cuomo who are going to trial later in this year for charges like bid rigging and bribery. We have not really seen everybody coming together on some kind of ethics reform to address that. I know the Assembly is looking at so-called procurement reform to maybe have a little more oversight on some of these economic development contracts, including contracts related to the Buffalo Billion, some of Cuomo's major economic development projects that are getting quite a few people at least accused of some very bad things right now. I mean, do you see that happening? Could you think you could get together with the Senate and do some kind of reform to have a little bit better oversight of these programs?
Well, there's certainly a lot more conversation about it, and I think there could be a coming together around that issue. You know, and this is one of these that we talk about, we're trying to strike the appropriate balance, which is, on the one hand, you want your economic development programs to have the flexibility and the speed with which decisions are made so you can respond to a marketplace that's changing pretty rapidly. But by the same token, you want to make sure that you have all the appropriate checks and balances to make sure that state and other public monies aren't being used in inappropriate ways. And clearly, the trials that will happen both at the state and federal level throughout the fall and perhaps even into the early winter are going to tell us a lot about what happened. In some respects, I'm not exactly sure what happened. All we know is that it's clearly raised serious concerns among the law enforcement community. So we're going to take a look at that. So whether we do that before the end of session or whether that reform waits until we've seen the trials and we understand exactly what the fact patterns are, I don't know, but it's getting a lot of attention, and there's a lot of our members are talking energetically about what we do to try to address it. It's a real concern.
Well, as far as procurement reform, we actually held a press conference a year ago outlining some basic principles of what we thought
I remember that
would be better checks and balances. One of those is to create an oversight of State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli and then the State Attorney General to have kind of a final review once the deal was struck.
Because the controller was cut out of the process in 2011, we should point out.
Correct. So it doesn't...
What's that reinstated?
It doesn't get in the way of making the deal. It just makes sure that whatever the deal has done has been the right deal for the taxpayers. In the Senate this year, they've passed a bill to have term limits for legislative leaders, term limits for committee chairs. That's exactly the platform we're campaigning on. I think it would be very important for the Assembly Democrats to do that this year and do the exact bill that the Senate's doing, because what you're really trying to get at is the grasp of power that is embedded with the system. And this is not about Republicans being in charge versus the Assembly Democrats. This is clearly when you have someone that's been a committee chair for 20 years, and anything that goes to that committee, that chair has to sign off on, that's power. When you don't have term limits for legislative leaders, minority and majority, someone can get embedded for a long time like Shelley Silver did, and then accumulates lots of power. And so you have to start chipping away at the system, and that's why I'm hoping that the Assembly Democrats will take this bill up that's already passed the Senate with bipartisan support, because that is not about partisan politics. It doesn't take anything away from the majority being the majority. It's about trying to chip away at the embedded power that exists in the state legislature.
Where do you guys stand on having a full-time legislature and just getting rid of any kind of outside income, paying an adequate salary, that would be your only job, and that would be what you'd be concentrating on? What do you think?
Yeah, Joe, go ahead.
Well, I think there's actually a fair amount of support in our House. I wouldn't speak for Brian, but in the majority for limiting outside income. We've passed a bill that would dramatically limit outside income. So, the only caveat to that is this, that there is value even in the modern world, to having people with outside experiences bring them to bear in legislative deliberations. Having said that, the government is very complex now, particularly the government of New York, $160 billion budget. It's nuanced. When you start talking about Medicaid formulas, when you talk about energy policy, you really have to spend enormous amounts of time. When I first came to Albany, I owned a software development company, and I found each passing year the amount of time I could focus on my private sector interests got smaller and smaller, to the point where I really was not around and had to really do this full time, and it just demanded that of you. So I think there would be some support in our House for additional ethics reform and for essentially creating high limits on or significant limits on outside income. I don't think that the Senate agrees with us, and I, just a point of disclosure, few members of the Assembly majority or the Assembly at all really have a lot of outside economic activity. I think it is a much greater number in the Senate still of members who have substantial outside interests, so that may actually help determine what our positions are.
Okay, Brian?
The short version is I'm certainly open to the discussion. I'll just give you the political reality. Downstate in New York City and Long Island, the constituents would probably not really care. They don't care that you have a full-time legislature, and they probably don't care how much you pay them. You get north of Westchester County and come this way, and when you start telling people I'm a part-time legislator, at least that's how it's been presented, and you're making a base salary of $79.5, and if you get a stipend as a committee person, that could be add another $10,000 to your, so it's now $89.5. It's already been embedded in people's minds in upstate that this is a part-time job. There's most people's reaction, at least in this area, is I'd like to have a part-time job that pays, you know, $89,000. Although the reality is it's not a part-time job. I do this full-time. There are many legislators that do this full-time already. You can make a case looking at the legislative calendar, which is what a lot of people do. You know, we're going to be out of Albany at the end of June. But when we're back home from January to June and then from July to August, we are everywhere in our district dealing with meetings with constituents, trying to solve problems. And people don't see that, and that doesn't make any headlines. And so that's where the rub is, and that's why it's tough to get some upstate legislators to support a concept of a full-time legislature dealing with the public pushback. And but certainly downstate, when you look at New York City, I think the New York City Council representatives make, I'm going to say, $165,000, $170,000. And so a New York City, you know, legislator is only making $89,900, and they're making all the trips back and forth to Albany, and they're saying, you know, really? And I think, and one of the things I'll just add one other point, I think we're finding it more difficult to find quality candidates to serve in Albany. Because of the amount of time you're away from home, the amount of static you take from everybody, including the media, it sometimes cannot be a fun endeavor. And you have to keep reminding yourself, well, this is about public service. This is why I'm doing it. But it gets tougher and tougher. And to Joe's one other point that I would agree with is that I came from a business background. When I went to the state legislature, I had local government experience, school board experience, and that really helped. Some people still maintain their business interests, which is, God bless them, they may have a different setup. So those type of people you might not be able to attract to serve in the legislature, which means you're also losing some talent because those people have been successful in another life.
And I will say, yeah. I was not too long ago, I was in my local district office, a group of people around the table, we were talking about some issue that the group wanted me to address. And as the meeting was breaking up, one of the gentlemen shook my hand. He said, so you're on vacation now. And I said, well, I don't know about you, but I'd rather be laying next to a pool and have some suntan lotion and a good book if I were on vacation. I'm actually working, as you can see. But I think to Brian's point, there's an expectation that if you're not in Albany, you're not working. But honestly, I think we probably work harder on some level. We're in our districts, so we're meeting with groups, we're out touring facilities, we're talking to people about legislative remedies to a whole host of issues. So probably my days are longer and I meet with more people in Rochester than I do even in Albany, which is sort of, you know, gives credence to the idea that this has really become a full-time job if you're doing your job.
All right, I'm going to turn to our audience who have questions. I'll start right here. Ma'am, your name and go ahead.
Jillian from Geneseo, back again talking about health care. The reason I'm pushing this is because I actually run an activist group in Geneseo, and we're turning our attention to healthcare in general, advocacy-wise, at the federal level, but more and more I see we got a real shot at single payer, and I'd like to know from both of your perspectives how you feel about it and if you could get a little bit detailed. Because the bill doesn't address how we're going to deal with the present insurance companies.
Yeah, so thanks for the question. Again, people will be shocked. I'm one of the few Democrats in the Assembly who didn't vote for the single-payer bill that comes before us. I haven't voted for it in the past. Not because I'm necessarily opposed to conceptually setting up a system in which you don't have private insurance companies, whether they're for-profit or not-for-profit. The problem with the way that the bill is constructed is this, that the costs of insurance, the costs of health care, are borne currently by public payers, which is Medicare and Medicaid, and then private insurers. What most people don't realize is if a health care provider had to rely entirely on the rates of Medicare or Medicaid, they frankly could not function. Most of the services, particularly when you get past sort of primary care into some of the specialties, the cost of the reimbursement doesn't even cover anywhere near the cost of actually providing that service. So what you have in New York and most states, all states, is the subsidization of commercial insurance reimbursement rates to the public programs. So if you were to eliminate the private insurance, what would happen in order for you to maintain any level of excellence in healthcare provision, you'd have to dramatically increase public reimbursement, which means you have to pay for that. So some of the administrative savings that are talked about in Medicaid or Medicare, what they do is they simply just take the current structure and apply it, extrapolate it as though you could continue to maintain the system as is, but you can't. So you'd have to see dramatic increases in the public reimbursements, and that might, in some ways, would dramatically offset some of the savings on the administrative side. The second thing that you would have as well is in the bill that passed the Assembly, it actually encourages, part of the provisions, encourages healthcare providers to come together to negotiate with the government for higher rates. So, which means not only would you have to then compensate for the subsidization that doesn't exist anymore, but you'd be in a position where you'd have under the bill provisions which direct you to actually negotiate for even higher rates, which makes the cost even higher. There's very little in the proposal that we've seen, that I've seen, that does anything around cost containment, that does anything around holding down the cost. The truth is, Americans love to talk about health insurance. We love to have this debate about private sector, public sector, affordable health care, et cetera. The real challenge in America is this, and no one wants to say this, frankly, on either side, which is that the cost of health care is driven by the fact that obesity is on the rise, that we have the grain of America, which is fine. It just, you can't argue that people are going to live to be 100 and not have health care costs go up dramatically to pay for that. What we need is a real conversation about costs. We need a conversation about containment of costs. We need to have a rational conversation about how we calibrate insurance premiums to match what those growing costs are, and to figure out how to incorporate things like telehealth, real wellness programs, things that would help people change lifestyle so that they don't have these long-term chronic illnesses that we pay for. When we have that conversation, and then that's done appropriately, I think we could have a thoughtful conversation as well about how you deliver those services. But under the current system, I don't think and certainly the legislation that's been advanced to the Assembly, as much as, you know, I have a great relationship with my good friend Dick Gottfried, who's the sponsor of the bill. I don't think the conversation has been full enough to capture all of that in the conversation.
Hey, Brian?
Ditto.
All right.
Ditto. That, Joe's explanation was spot on. And as you can tell, that has nothing to do with partisan politics. This is about trying to come up in a very difficult way, as you can even see at the national level, trying to come up with a comprehensive health program that serves every American and does so at a cost that all of us can afford, whether it's directly out of our pocket, you know, that we're paying, or whether the money that's being raised in taxes to help pay for it. It is not an easy answer, and there's a lot of actuarial studies out there that say the cost, as sort of proposed for single payer, would be billions just in New York State, forgetting the country. So it's certainly, to Joe's point, conversations that we have to have, difficult conversations, but certainly the bill that was proposed in the Assembly is certainly not the answer.
All right, let me just ask, may I
add one other thing, though, that
sure,
I forget?
Sure, and I'll let her follow up, but go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, one thing that you don't have to say ditto on this because you may not agree with me, but the notion is, in my view, everyone has to have health insurance. This notion that somehow some people can get out of it, like, well, I have a body, but I'm not going to have it covered, and I'll take care of myself, thank you. It's simply not going to fly. In New York, if you own an automobile, you have automobile insurance. Every single person who has an automobile. So I was at a conference once, and a woman came up to me and said, we shouldn't have to have health insurance. We should do just what you do on auto insurance. And I said, well, I'm sorry, excuse me, I don't understand that. She said, well, I don't have to have a car. I said, can you not have a body? And she didn't seem to, I didn't do that great at Geneseo, but I remember Logic 101. That sort of seemed to be an analogy that would. So I do think if we're going to have this conversation, everyone has to have health insurance, whether it's a public or private program. You can't opt out and then decide, well, gee, I don't feel well. Maybe I'll buy the insurance now. One other reminder, New York State had a ban on exclusions because of pre-existing conditions in state law already. We had the ability for young people to buy their parents' policies already. We had a ban on lifetime caps already. So New York was pretty progressive in its treatment of health care before the Affordable Care Act, and some of those provisions remain in state law.
But all right, so anyway. Let her follow up. Go ahead.
I don't have a follow-up.
No? Okay, I thought you certainly... Okay, well, very good. Well, let me turn this one.
They stumped her.
Yeah. She's been waiting for a while. Go right ahead.
Hi, my name is Mary Caitlin White. I'm an adjunct professor down at SUNY Geneseo in the School of Education, also an alumni.
yeah.
And my question has to pertain to education. The foundation aid that schools are owed is over $4 billion right now. This prompted me to start attending the Greece School Board meetings to find out what can we be doing, and I ended up running this year, and I'm now going to be a school board member.
Congratulations.
And, thank you. But when we look at these budgets, there's not a district in New York not operating under austerity measures right now, and we want a better future for New York. We got to fund those schools. We got to fund those teachers. We got to fund those programs. So what is the plan for New York to pay schools the money that they're owed? This isn't extra money. It's the money that was promised.
And I would just add, I believe you're talking about the court decision, right? Campaign for Fiscal Equity over a decade ago that was interpreted to mean that the state should give billions more to schools and has not really been carried out.
Correct.
Brian, does the state owe that money?
Evan, look at the time.
No, sir. No, we've got just enough.
Pardon me if I can cough through my answer. I believe it does. But then you get to the fiscal reality as where is the money going to come from? Because we have added more money to education. We spend more money on education combined with state investment and local property taxpayer investment. In the country. And people make the argument, well, that's right, but you still owe us money. And then, you know, this is why all these conversations were created on Common Core and results. And, you know, you look at the money right here in our backyard in the city of Rochester, look, and the money we're spending, look at the graduation rates, which are unacceptable. We've got lots of issues, and just throwing money isn't the answer. And an award that says you have to pay this, well, then that's fine, but you have to pay it responsibly because you asked the average homeowner, are your property taxes, you okay with them going up some more? You're 90% are going to say absolutely not. And then when you look at the other, as Joe mentioned, we're a $160 billion budget. The majority of the money we spend is on education and Medicaid, and that's a whole nother discussion. To your point, understand it, get it. I've served on the school board. I know those are tough decisions. Certainly having the tax cap, which the average property taxpayer likes. But if you talk to a school board member, they say we don't like that because it ties our hands because we need to go out and raise more revenue. So it's not just an easy yes and then write a check. They're complicating factors.
All right, Joe, if you try to keep it to about a minute. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, I do think clearly we set an aspirational goal with foundation aid, and we're struggling since the financial crisis of nearly a decade ago to get back to where we were in terms of funding. I will say this. A lot of our money goes to urban education. To Brian's point, the challenge has been for people in poverty, we have not served them well, and we have not designed a system to really help people in poverty succeed in school, because the problems they have are largely not in the school. It's all the problems they face in their life outside of the school. We're trying to do something here with the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative and other initiatives to try to address that. When we do that, we'll see that we'll be able to have quality education for perhaps not less money, but we'll be able to make those dollars go much further. We'll have better outcomes. We'll have better results for teachers and students.
But you can forget about that money, it sounds like?
No, I think we would like to get there, and we're getting closer. We're about $4 billion away. We've closed the gap. We'll continue to try to close the gap. But it is not without having to take money away from health care, infrastructure, and all the other things that we spend money on. It is effectively a zero-sum game unless the public suddenly shows an appetite for much greater taxation. I don't think that's the case.
Let's let her ask a quick follow-up. Got to be real quick. Go ahead.
I just wanted to take a little conversation about that we're throwing money at the problem of schools. I used to be a public school teacher. I haven't yet seen any money thrown at schools. I think we're kind of in desperate need. Class sizes are too big. You know, let's give that a try. Let's try throwing more money at it, and maybe we can get these kids better served because they're not.
All right, thank you. And again, I think you heard what both the legislative leaders said, so it sounds like Some agreements, I think, in many ways here. And Karen, maybe some final thoughts from you as we wrap up here. What are the big questions that are unanswered on your mind here, Karen, as we go throughout the rest of this next 4 weeks or so?
Well, I think I've already asked some of them. It's just that, you know, are there going to be any big issues decided? And it kind of sounds like maybe there's not going to be. Maybe we're going to have a little bit of a break or something. I guess, the looming thing that we haven't gotten into is how is President Trump and the Republican-led Congress, if they do some of the proposals they want to do with repealing Obamacare, which would mean cutting a lot of Medicaid aid to New York State, and changes in tax reform that could hurt New York. I mean, our state budget could be short billions of dollars. You talk about not funding education. You could have a multi-billion dollar hole in the healthcare budget. And I know it's just hard to predict what's going to happen because so far they haven't been able to agree on any of these things, but you guys certainly got to be thinking about that.
And like, I will say, luckily for you guys, we really are out of time.
Well, we'll stay tuned then.
All right, okay.
But that is one that I'm sure you will see our Capitol Bureau correspondent covering those issues as they pertain to state government. We'll see. There's a lot of unanswered questions in the air from the federal level and how they trickle down to New York State. But I just want to say, first of all, I think we've got the best journalist in Albany here, Karen DeWitt, and we're just thrilled to have her here. Thank you, Karen.
Thank you.
Just an absolute honor. Thank you for being here. And our thanks as well to Brian Kolb and Joe Morelli from the New York State Assembly. It's wonderful to have both of them, two of the most accessible leaders you'll have. I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks to the whole crew out here. Have a wonderful afternoon, and we'll talk to you Thursday on Member Supported Public Radio.